Before I start with things I'm going to say today, maybe this is a good time to see if anyone has any questions, especially if you've been practicing at home, the meditation practice. Do you have any questions about the meditation you're doing? And
hi. So when I'm doing, focusing on or trying to pay attention to thinking, I guess I'm the type of person that when I have a thought, I just get on that boat and, 15 minutes later, I'm like, wow, that was a long ride. So when I'm focusing on thinking, I think it seems that I almost have this tendency to, if I get a thought, to just kind of shove it away as opposed to just observing it.
Oh, so because you have such a strong tendency to get carried away by the thought.
I'm afraid to watch the slow boat move.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Okay.
So is that just something to notice, or is there anything to do with it?
Great, that's a great, yes. So the underlying or the basic idea we're trying to do, just notice what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So if you notice that you're trying to push it away, then notice that really carefully. Note that, be aware of that. And as you're noticing, it might loosen up, it might lighten up, you might realize you don't have to hold it at bay so strongly. Mm-hmm. And that could be enough. Now, if it's easy enough to relax, that's also good. But if you relax and you drift off in thought, then maybe you have to find the middle ground, and it might take a while to find it.
Okay.
But the way to find it is just become more and more familiar with what you do, what your tendencies are, and what you've noticed is great. It's progress along the way.
Okay.
And one of the things that can help with mindfulness of thinking, especially if there's a strong tendency to spend a lot of time in thought, is the cultivation of mindfulness of the body. Because the more you're in touch with your body, the sooner you'll have the cues and the reference point to notice you're drifting off in thought. If you get really used to being present in your body, it becomes almost like, at some point maybe second nature to feel like you're in your body, then you'll notice when you leave your body to go into thoughts. If you're always kind of in your thoughts, you might not notice that you're leaving in your thoughts because that's the world you know it. No. But if you have this solid place in your body, then you can notice the feeling of kind of getting disconnected, disembodied, kind of drifting off.
There seems to be a starkness to it. I don't necessarily care for reality. I'm not all enthused about being here now.
And sorry?
Being here now, it's kind of an imaginary world is rather pleasant.
Okay, yeah.
And the starkness of it, I mean, I find myself trying to fantasize, and then it's like stale bread. I mean, I don't.
The fantasy is, or reality is.
No, the fantasy is. It's lost its its savor. I mean, it's like, what am I doing? I come back to being at work with people I can't stand and doing a task I don't care for. But that's the reality of it.
So let me see if I follow you. So reality itself is not so appealing to you, so interesting.
Value. No.
But now as you're doing this practice, fantasy that used to be kind of interesting for you is losing its appeal. It's getting stale. Is that right?
Yeah. It's. I'm damned both ways. It's what I'm trying
I understand.
To communicate.
Yeah. So I understand. And the hope is that seeing all this, seeing how it all is, will allow you to keep looking deeper and deeper and find a new way to be in the world, a new way, a new understanding. And the world that you find, the real world that you're finding not so interesting or unappealing, and this is maybe what I'm going to talk about today, might help this. As you might find a whole different way, a whole different attitude or relationship to the world out there. Even if the world out there is unappetizing, unappealing, even disgusting, it can be at times. I saw a lot of disgust walking around today with my son trick-or-treating. But you could see, even if there's kind of terrible things in the world, the transformation is not in the world. Transformation is in your own heart and mind. And so as we do this mindfulness practice and start seeing reality more and more starkly, directly, there's a chance of that transformation, that change. And it becomes a radical change of attitude, a change of relationship that we have to the world. And then your mind, your heart, becomes like this beacon, this beautiful light that can shine even on things which are not so pleasant. And you won't be bothered by the unpleasant things as much. It's not saying that things are now going to be pleasant, but you won't be bothered by the unpleasant things. If you have coworkers that you don't get along with because of their behavior, you'll be more relaxed about it. You won't be caught by it. You'll be pulled into that world. And probably the world will respond to you in a different way as a result as well. And because it's so mutual. And probably your world will start changing as well. Does that make sense?
Let's see.
We'll see.
I'll wait and see.
We'll see. Thank you. Hang in there. It's well worth it. Reality is the leading cause for insanity for those who are in touch with it.
I have a question about the relationship of dreams to meditation.
Yes.
Just how do you see that?
So you have to explain a little bit more why you're interested in the question.
Well, I'm always aware of dreaming, but as I my dreams are coming more interesting or more.
As you meditate, you're finding your nighttime dreams to become more vivid.
Yes, yeah.
That can happen. There's generally three things that happen around dreaming when people start meditating. One is nothing happens different. Just the other is that some people find they actually seemingly dream less. And they become less aware of dreams, or they dream less. And the other is people become more vividly aware of their dreams. So those are the three things that happen. So I don't know, different people is different things. For me, over time, it's been different. And in general, as people meditate, they tend to become more aware of what can be called the kind of the unconscious, subconscious life. And one of the places that comes out is in dreams. Then the question some people want to ask is, how do I practice? How do I bring mindfulness to the experience of dreaming? Now, there are some people who practice lucid dreaming. And there are some Buddhists who will teach the practice of lucid dreaming. You stay aware while you dream. And there might be some advantages to that, benefits to that. There's also some feeling that maybe it's not a good idea to be aware while you're dreaming, because that's the one place where the mind has a chance to process things without you interfering. What we do with dreams in this tradition here is, if there's a strong dream and you wake up from the dream, then we don't analyze the dream, like with symbolism and all that. That could be valuable, but that's not what we would do if we did mindfulness meditation. Rather, what you do is you sit up and meditate on the feelings and emotions that are left over from having that dream. And then you use those feelings, the emotions that are left over, that are there from the dream, as the entryway into get deeper into that experience of what's going on. Make sense?
Yeah, what I've experienced is the amount of... I'm blown away by the amount of planning that my brain does and how I see its apprehension of something. That the planning is a response to something that's within me, and it's pervasive.
And this is
not in the dream. There's
plenty of people who are really surprised. They start paying attention, really looking, who are surprised by how pervasive something like a fear might be.
Right. And it's a thing that I've not liked, because I've known I've had it, but I've kind of walked through it. I've never let it stop the initiative or things that I do. But it's just interesting how pervasive it is.
Yeah, so from the point of view of this practice, it's very, very valuable to discover that. And it's a step towards freedom from the fear. And so rather than turning away from it again, in a sense, we go through it. And willingly go into the fear, not necessarily go find a scary place, scary house to go into, but when you sit and meditate, if the fear is there, really feel it well. Really bring it into your full conscious awareness. And be present for it, hang with it, explore it, see what happens if you let the fear, if it has a chance to really be there for you and really kind of show itself, as if it finally has a chance to be in the sun, and then see what happens. And it's possible to transform it, to go through it, and come out to the other side. Yes?
I find that watching my breath changes quite a bit and becomes forced and unnatural feeling compared to when I'm just breathing throughout the day, not paying attention to my breathing. And it seems the more I pay attention, the more unnatural the breathing feels.
Unnatural in what way?
Like rate and depth. And
sorry?
The rate and the depth. And
what way does it change?
It feels like it takes a lot more muscle energy to breathe when I'm concentrating on it.
Are you breathing faster or bigger? Or?
Yeah.
Now, the... So as I've said, the basic thing we're trying to do here is just notice what is happening. And so if there's a controlled breath going on, then your job is to become the expert and really feel what a controlled breath is like. And that has two advantages. One is, if you give yourself permission to have a controlled breath, then you don't get anxious around having a controlled breath. If you get anxious, then people tie themselves in knots. Just be relaxed around it. The other is, as you start understanding it, looking at it, you might understand, start slowly, start understanding some of the forces inside of you that are bringing about the controlled breath. There might be some feeling, some belief, there might be some emotion, there might be fear connected to it, there might be some idea that you're supposed to be in charge and in control of things, and now you've discovered something you're not in control of, and you know, there's many things you might discover. So you want to hang in there and see what you can discover, how you operate, what's making you tick there. And as you discover that, maybe with time you can relax and let go. It's not so uncommon for people to end up kind of controlling or affecting their breath in the way you're talking about. Generally, it goes away with time. If you're new at this, it usually works itself out after a while. There are some people for whom watching the breath in meditation is counterindicated. It's not so useful because they have such a strong tendency to get wrapped up in it. They tie themselves in knots staying with it. And so then they're instructed to pay attention to something else or to change the way they're doing it. Some people find if they want to stay attentive to the breath is to be aware of the back rib cage. Because the back rib cage we have much less sense of control over than the front, if that's where you're watching the breath. And some people find by just feeling a much more subtle sensation of breathing in the back rib cage, their sense of control or effect lessens. The other is, as soon as you notice that you're controlling it, ignore the breathing for a while and focus on something completely different. And one of the things you can focus on is sounds, and do a listening meditation. And listening sounds you can't really control. So some people find it's much more relaxing to listen to sounds. Just stay in the present moment with sounds, hearing. And then some people find that very effective kind of grounding in the present moment. If something else becomes predominant, then you leave the sound and go to the body sensations or whatever. If you do a listening meditation and you get fairly concentrated or pretty calm, then you might be able to ease back into the breath without having the effect that you're talking about. So that was a lot. Does that make some sense? So last one.
So one thing I've noticed is the last week when I was meditating, my mind was fairly clear and my body was restless. And this week it's just the opposite, where my mind is not stopping, but my body is very calm. Does that happen? And I guess you're going to now say, pay attention to that and
ask
deeper questions.
You know, mostly my job in terms of telling people, you know, talking to people about their meditation experience, my job is mostly to normalize everything. Oh yeah, that can happen. That's the way it can be that way. You know, just keep paying attention. It's fine. Let's do a meditation. Taking a comfortable, alert posture. And it's often good, usually good, to give some emphasis at the beginning on the alert part of the posture. Sitting up a little bit straighter than you normally would. bringing a little bit more sense of vitality to your spine. And then keeping the core, the spine, alert and upright, taking a few long, slow, deep breaths, and then relaxing all around that spine, around the upright core. Taking some deep breaths and softening the shoulders. Deep breath in, on the exhale, softening the chest and the ribcage. Deep breath in, and as you exhale, soften the belly, let it hang forward. Maybe one more deep breath, and as you exhale, soften your face, jaws, forehead. Return to normal. Being at ease with whoever you are, whatever's going on. Easing up. Taking a few more moments to feel your body. Connecting to your physical experience. The weight of your body. The solidity of your body. Energy or sense of vitality in your body. And then within your body, as part of your body, feeling how the body experiences breathing. The movement of your body as you breathe. Sensations that change as you inhale and exhale. putting aside your thoughts and concerns of the day in favor of entering the world of your body breathing. There's a rhythm of breathing in and breathing out. Hang in there with that rhythm. Hang in there with the succession of breaths. There's no need to judge anything or comment about anything. It's enough now just to be still and notice how it is for you. Relax the thinking mind, the thinking muscle, and begin again with your breathing. Meditation can often entail beginning over again, over and over. Be relaxed. Just begin whenever you can back to your breathing. And then as we continue this session of meditation, let go of your breathing a little bit and notice instead, what's your attitude? What's your attitude? What attitude is present in your mind or your heart? Can you notice the general attitude of the mind? Is it an attitude of being engaged? Attitude of being hesitant? Attitude of wanting? Seeking? Attitude of resistance? Aversion? Impatience? Contentment? Attitude is a little bit connected to motivation. Wanting something. And if you can notice the general attitude, foreground attitude or the background attitude that's present, hold that in mindful awareness. Note it, name it, in a sense, look at it head on, feel it. See if you can be present for it without being caught in its grip, in its orbit. And if you're mindful of your attitude, hold it in non-reactive, non-judgmental awareness. What happens to it? Does it get stronger, weaker? Does it change, go away? The attitude that you have, the attitude of your mind, is closely connected to the quality of the mind. Is the quality of the mind one which is pleasant or unpleasant for you? Is the quality of your mind peaceful or agitated? And as you're mindful of your attitude, your attitude of the qualities of mind, or if you come back and begin again with your breathing, as you're mindful of your breathing, what's the quality of that mindfulness? Is the mindfulness clean and simple? Or is it mixed up with some attitude? And then for the last couple of minutes of the sitting, come back again to your breathing and trust that for the next 2 minutes, all you need to do is be with your breath, your breathing. Entrust yourself to your breathing. So the first week, talked about mindfulness of breathing as kind of a foundation. Second week, mindfulness of the body. Third week, mindfulness of emotions. And the fourth week, mindfulness of thoughts and thinking. And this week, the theme or the is mindfulness of the mind. And the mind is a kind of, in some ways, a vast topic or phenomena. It's possible that, you know, by we say it this way, that in India, in the Buddhist languages, the word for mind and heart was the same word, citta. And if apparently if you ask someone where they thought, they wouldn't point to their head, but they point to their heart. So that's where the people identify the thinking organ. So, you know, in English we tend to divide the heart and the mind. And we tend to use the word mind. But if we remember that in Buddhism, it's very closely connected to what we might call the heart as well. It can feel like a richer phenomena than just the mind. And in fact, the mind, or this heart-mind, is considered to be one of the most precious things that we have. And paying attention to the quality of the mind is a very important activity of mindfulness practice. When you have something precious, it's good to know where it is, and it's good to take care of it and maintain a good quality for it. Many people don't know where their mind is. And they don't care for it very well. Some people are more careful with the clothes they wear than caring for their mind. Some people exercise their body and clean their body and do all kinds of things for their body, but they don't care for the mind in the same way. Meditation is one of those ways we care for the mind. And for some people, it becomes as basic and as essential as to meditate every day as it is to brush your teeth. And it, you know, you don't get cavities if you brush your teeth, and you don't get, what's the equivalent in the mind of cavities?
Neurosis.
Neurosis. You don't get neurosis if you meditate every day. And meditation is one of those ways that helps maintain a good quality of mind. And one of the remarkable things about meditation over time, and as it deepens, is the quality of the mind gets better and better. And you get to have it beautiful. It becomes one of the most, I would say for me, the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen is a purified mind, purified heart. It's something, you know, it's more beautiful than any art and thing of nature. It's a beautiful thing. And to have some sense of the beauty of the mind, the preciousness of it, is a wonderful thing. And I didn't know that until I started practicing, starting meditation practice. So the mind is closely connected to, in Buddhism, the word citta, or the mind, is not all the functioning of the mind as, or the brain as we think about maybe in English. The mind is more like, when we say focus on the mind, or the mindfulness of the mind, we mean the state of the mind, the mind state. And the mind will always have a state. You might be thinking about particular things, but the attitude of the mind, the state of the mind, might be related to what you're thinking or not related to what you're thinking. So, you know, I'm capable of being grumpy. And this morning I was a little bit grumpy because my day was not what I planned it to be. So, you know, it took a little while. I got a little grumpy a little bit. And I could see that, you know, I was thinking about all kinds of things. But that grumpiness kind of went with me, you know, went with all those thoughts. Well, you know, I could think about what I was going to do, shopping, you know, or something else, something relatively innocent. And that attitude of grumpiness kind of stayed there. So an attitude can go with you. Or it could be an attitude of sometimes I feel a lot of love. And that love goes with me. And I go around and what I encounter or what I think about somehow happens within this field, this quality, this sense, this attitude of love or kindness or something might be there, compassion. So the attitude might be a little bit more lasting than the particular content of what we're thinking. And sometimes even the content of what we're feeling in terms of kind of the flow of emotions. The attitude might be something actually bigger. There are some attitudes that might be very subtle, which maybe are there all the time. Like gentlemen who talked earlier about fear or sometimes anxiety. It's always there for some people. And it's just kind of a little bit there in the background. Maybe you don't always aware of it. Maybe not aware of it even at all. Some people are not just grumpy occasionally, but they're always grumpy. Or they're always aversive. There's kind of this kind of subtle, maybe subtle, not so subtle, kind of background kind of atmosphere of aversion that's always there. And they're not necessarily thinking about it all the time, and sometimes they're even not being, you know, not acting aversively. Maybe they're acting kindly. But there's kind of a little bit, there's this lingering attitude in the background. But sometimes the attitude or the quality or the state of the mind might be subtle, and sometimes it's quite evident. Often the attitude or the quality of the mind has a lot to do with attitude, and attitude has a lot to do with how we're relating to something. It can be our relationship to a particular thing, it can be a relationship to something more general, or it could be just kind of an open relationship, like a blank check, you know, that is, you know, just like we just kind of have a particular relationship we have with, no matter what happens. We're angry, and whoever walks through the door, we're angry. You know, it's like this kind of, we're like a, you know, so there can be an attitude or relationship we have. And this points to a very important thing, aspect of mindfulness practice. And the simple way of saying this is that in any given moment, it's a little bit simplistic, but in any given moment, there are two things happening. There is what's happening, and it's our relationship to what's happening. And often people focus a lot on what's happening, but they don't really focus a lot on their relationship to what's happening, their attitude to what's happening. So I could be following my breathing, and I think, you know, I've been instructed to stay with your breath, watch your breath, be present for your breath. Great, so I'll just stay with the breath. The breath is the name of the game, so I'll just be with the breath. Not noticing that there's an attitude of striving, trying to hold on to the breath so I can really get concentrated. This greed for concentration might be there. Or there might be, the breath might feel unpleasant. And so I say, okay, I'm told just be pleasant, be present for the unpleasant, feel the unpleasant, that's what Gil says, you know, just feel it, so just notice. But the way that I'm noticing is, might be, oh, I hate doing this, but I guess I'm going to notice. And so, but, you know, the attitude of, you know, aversion towards doing the practice, the aversion in the noting, well, that's not the breath, so that's off stage. That's not something you want to pay attention to, right? But we pay attention to everything. And sometimes it's very important to notice that there's what's happening, and then there's our relationship to it. And the relationship often is not innocent. The relationship is often, you know, we're engaged in some way. Sometimes there's advancing engagement attitudes. We want something, we want to go towards something. And sometimes there's pulling back, or sometimes there's pushing things away. And those kind of pushing, withdrawing, going towards, can take, or hitting, you know, attacking. Those kind of movements of the mind can take the form of desire, take the form of aversion, can take a form of a variety of kind of motivations, desires. So one of the things to do in mindfulness practice is periodically, when you're paying attention to something, is to ask yourself, what is your relationship to what is happening? So you're feeling some discomfort. We don't just pay attention to discomfort, we also notice the relationship we have towards the discomfort. And as you notice the relationship to it, is that a relationship which represents a way that you want to be? Are you clinging? Are you resisting? Are you relaxed? Are you open-handed? Are you generous? Are you kind about whatever you're paying attention to? What is the relationship you're forming with that, whatever's happening? And this is a very important part of life, because the suffering, the stress and the suffering that Buddhism is meant to be a liberation from has a lot to do not with how things are, but our relationship to things. So it's not about how our coworkers are. It's not about, you know, what's happening in the world, not about, you know, what's happening within us. But the process of being free has a lot to do with how we relate to what's happening. There are things in the world that we can have no control over whatsoever. Not only the external world, but the inner world as well. At any given day, you might wake up with a terminal illness, with a lot of pain. And maybe there's nothing can be done about it. Externally, or with it. But a lot can be done about your relationship to it. So in Buddhist circles, they talk sometimes about healing as opposed to a cure. And healing sometimes, in Buddhist circles at least, doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to survive a terminal illness. But you get healed, there's a psychological change of attitude where somehow we find ourselves at peace with what's going. We find ourselves back into some quality of well-being that is not being influenced or not being affected by a particular tragedy or difficulty in our life. So begin looking at our relationship to our experience is a very important one, and that gives us access a little bit to understanding what's the attitude right now. And that gives us a chance perhaps to look at what can we let go of, what can we change, and give us access, start giving access to a higher quality of inner life, higher quality of heart, higher quality of mind. Does that make sense? So what questions do you have about that so far?
So quite concretely then, if you find that you have this attitude of being put upon, say.
Attitude of being put upon.
Yeah, so you've been doing a whole lot of stuff all day long, and all of a sudden you realize, you think, am I the only one working here? Why is everybody's always asking me? And so I want to let go of that. But how can I do that?
Well, you know, the first and foremost response in the mindfulness practice is be mindful of it. Don't be in a hurry to get rid of something. Don't get in a hurry, even though it's unpleasant. And the human tendency is, okay, let's get rid of this. Let's get free of it as quickly as we can. And mindfulness has a lot to do with, let's get to know it first. Because if you let go of something before you got to know it, it might come back and get you later. You know, and it might come back at a time when you don't have the luxury of being mindful. You know, or really look at it. So you want to study it and get to know it and learn it. So later when it reappears, you have some wisdom and understanding about it. So being put upon. Some people have attitudes of... It can be very basic, unconscious attitudes of, for example, the world is a dangerous place. Or an attitude of, everything is oppressing. There's all constant oppression, being bothered, being troubled by everything. Everything is difficult. There can be attitudes we carry with us all the time that the world is for me to... The world is there to serve me and provide me with pleasure. And if it's not somehow building up my sense of self or my pleasure, then I'm just going to ignore it, push away, and just kind of constantly searching, for how can this world increase my pleasure, or my delight, or my sense of self, or something. There can be attitudes of, some attitudes seemingly are quite beautiful to have, like an attitude that the world is benign and beautiful, and supportive for me, and very, very life-affirming kind of attitudes people can have. There's world-negating, life-negating attitudes people can have. So first is to really notice this, and it can be real, some of these attitudes are so subtle. So once you've noticed and got to know it, then you could study where is that, is there any, also all the other factors we've been looking at in these 4 weeks then come into play. So are there physical sensations connected to it? Is somehow your breath being affected? And chances are, if the attitudes often affect breathing, so sometimes you might see that. Is it affect your physical experience? Is there some way that your shoulders are tense, or your stomach is tight, or something, or your skin feels kind of, like it's crawling? And then, is there any emotions connected to the attitude? And then you can kind of explore the mindfulness of emotions. And then there's a whole cognitive area of mindfulness of thoughts. And sometimes you want to actually start understanding some of the beliefs that might be connected. You might be telling yourself stories. Sometimes attitudes are connected to some story or idea or belief about what life is. You know, this belief, oh, life is a dangerous place. It's a threatening place. There's always these threats at every corner. And so always, you know, kind of checking, making sure. And that's kind of a belief. The world is a threatening place. Or the world is here to serve me. Or something. So to do the mindfulness, kind of explore all this. And one of the things to notice is there any tension or pressure or grasping or clinging in relationship to the attitude? And if you can find some kind of grasping, clinging, tension, pressure connected to it, then you can bring your attention very closely into that grasping, that clinging, that pressure. You know, feel it physically, feel it mentally, feel it whatever way you can. And kind of like your... when my son went to kindergarten, they had this... Once a week they did sculpture with beeswax. And whenever they started, the beeswax was cold. And so cold beeswax you can't do anything with. So the first thing they do is they just hold it in their hands. And with time, it got warm. And as it got warm, it softened. And as it softened, then they could shape it into something beautiful. But if you try to shape it when it's cold, it just breaks. So if you have some attitudes or some aspect of mind or heart which you don't like, it's difficult for you, and you try to change it too quickly, it'll just break. And so the first thing is kind of hold it in the warmth of your attention. And see if you can have an attitude. Again, your attitude. What's your relationship to an attitude which is painful? Oh, I hate it. Okay, can you let go of that? Can you kind of just be kind of easy with it? Can you be light with it? Just be present. And then kind of in a sense, this image of holding it, like you're holding beeswax in your hand, just hold it in the warmth of your awareness. And with time, it begins to soften. And as it softens, then it sometimes just lets go of itself. Or at some point it softens enough that you can shape it. You can like, rather it letting go of itself, you can let go of it, or you can transform it into something else. But this initial stage of just being present and paying attention, noticing it, being there with it. Now if you have a piece of beeswax and you hold it for 10 seconds, then you put it down. And then you come back later and pick it up and hold it for another 10 seconds, and then you put it down for a few minutes. It's not going to get warm. You have to stay there. So the same thing with the mindfulness practice. You have to stay present in order to let the warmth of attention to really kind of begin making the softening that happens. Does that make some sense?
Thank you.
Yes.
It seems like attitude could be confused with emotion. So like attitude of fear versus just the emotion of fear.
Right.
So do you have any tips, I guess, on how to notice the difference?
Remember that emotions are composite phenomena. They're not just a single thing. We say the word emotion, but an emotion is made up of many, you know, a variety of different things to come together to give us that emotion. There's physical sensations. There's sometimes a little attitude connected to it. There can be motivation. There can be there's a variety of things going on. But the difference between if you want to make a difference between emotions, so there's a big overlap as well. But the difference is that attitude is more pervasive than a particular emotion. So a person might have an overall attitude of the attitude might be desire. I just want something. You know, I don't even know what I want. I just want. Maybe that's not... You don't think of desire so much as being an emotion, perhaps, in English. But say that you're angry. And so I've had anger arise in my mind. And it's just like... It's a little thing... The anger arises as a subset of my mind. I can watch it arise in my mind, And there's a lot, a very clear sense that there's much more going on than this arising, this particular phenomenon of anger. There's a knowing of it, there's some stability, there's concentration, there's peace, there's a lot of things. And it's kind of like looking at it probably won't be this way for you, but for me I have this idea of, it's kind of like if you look at a big bowl of water and a bubble bubbles up in the middle of it. So I can watch that anger kind of just bubble up in the middle of it. And I'm much bigger. I'm the whole bowl of water. So the anger can be particular content. Or the whole bowl of water can be boiling. And so, or the whole bowl of water can be somehow tinted red. So an attitude is something that's more pervasive. It's broader. It's like the mood, the general mood that's within which all these little other things are happening and details are happening. So there could be a detail of anger, it could be a factor of anger going on that doesn't necessarily represent the overall mood. Or there can be an overall mood within which there might be other phenomena going on. There can be an overall mood of anger. But as you go through the day, there might be moments of kindness, there might be moments of generosity, there might be moments of other humor even that arises. Does that make sense? You're very kind saying it makes sense. It's a little bit confusing, I think, what I've said here today, because I'm saying two different things that overlap quite a bit. One is that it's a very important part of mindfulness practice is to notice your relationship to what it is you're paying attention to. There's what's happening, what you're paying attention to, and then your relationship to it. Now, you don't want to do this all the time, because then you kind of just tie yourself in knots, but periodically, just check in and say, what's my attitude here? What's my relationship to this experience? So the relationship and attitude I see is almost being synonymous. And then sometimes the attitude is very particular in the mind, just one particular functioning of the mind. And sometimes the attitude is the whole quality of mind, the whole mood. And sometimes a relationship you have with experience doesn't necessarily, the particular relationship does not necessarily speak to the overall mood or attitude of the mind in general. And sometimes it does. So there's a variety of things I'm talking about here, right? Sometimes, but you start with so one hand there's your particular relationship you have with particular things. And then there's also the general mood that you have that might be your relationship to life or yourself in a very general, big way. And these areas, your relationship to experience, your attitude, has a lot to do with the quality of your mind and your heart. And your heart is the most beautiful thing you have, I would say. And the heart is often covered over. The heart is the language of Buddhism. They say the heart is luminous, except for the taints, except for the taints or the defilements that visit it. So I like this. It's except for the things that visit. So in its essence, in a sense, the heart, the mind is beautiful. It's luminous. And but there are things that visit, and sometimes some are long-term visitors, and some settle on the outside and crust it over. But the heart, in its essence, is quite beautiful. And so, as we do this mindfulness practice, slowly, I hope, or quickly, I don't know, the beautiful quality, the beautiful nature of the heart begins to show itself. The mind begins to show itself. And then, with time, you want to safeguard that. You want to be. I think it becomes natural for people who meditate to, at some point, to become the caretakers of a good quality of mind and heart. So I'll give you an example of what that means. So you sit and meditate, perhaps in the morning, and you get some modicum of calm or peace. So calm and peace we might consider to be a much higher quality of heart or mind than being agitated or being afraid or being neurotic. So you notice that you're a little bit more calm and peaceful than you usually are. So then as you leave your meditation session, you notice that if you try to eat your breakfast and read the entire newspaper or check all the websites, like some people don't have newspapers anymore, and to squeeze the last possible piece of knowledge out of the news as you can before you go to work, and then you look at your clock and you rush out the door, you think, well, I know I have enough time to get to work. You know, it usually takes me, 1 minute. And it's now, 31 minutes before work starts, so I know I have enough time. But then the traffic lights are a little bit different today, and there's an accident on the freeway, and you didn't remember your car needed gas, and suddenly, you're all tense. So what I'm trying to say, so you notice this phenomena, that this attitude, you have to get the most out of your morning and savoring your time in your kitchen and reading the paper, and you start losing the quality of your, good quality of your mind because of this approach to living. And so, this is interesting. I had this beautiful thing, and now I lost it. I had this beautiful thing, and you notice that after maybe 100 days of this or 1,000 days of this, after a while, I said, wait a minute. Is this to my best interest? And it becomes the most natural thing in the world to say, wait a minute, I think I don't have to read the whole paper. I think there's something more important here than reading the entire paper. I think that the quality of my heart is much better. And you might also notice that if you safeguard, caretake your quality of your heart, when you get to work, it's better for the people at work too. You become available to people in a different way. You become available to be maybe more generous, be kinder, more helpful. If we end up kind of living a frantic life, living a life that's caught up in a quality of mind, quality of heart, which is not good, then we can't be as helpful to others as well. So it's not a selfish thing. In Buddhism, we say it's not a selfish thing to be concerned with the quality of your own heart. Traditionally in Buddhism, for many people, the motivation to caretake the good quality of their heart is so they can be more helpful to others. So, mindfulness. To pay attention to what is. To notice what's going on. And as we notice what's going on, to begin also looking at what is your relationship to what's going on. As you notice your neurosis. That was a good word today. The word of the day. As you notice your neurosis. Okay. What's your relationship to your neurosis? I hate it. I'm oppressed by it. It's so oppressive. Or I love it. Or that's all I know. It's all I know. I would just be lost without it. All those are relationships. All those are attitude towards. And if we don't include those as part of the meditation practice, the mindfulness practice, they're going to keep operating and keep us caught in the orbit, caught in the web. So we notice the neurosis, and we also can notice what's the relationship. And as I said, I think a couple of weeks ago, you want to be careful that you don't keep adding more arrows. So you notice your relationship, your attitude towards the neurosis, and you hate it. And then you hate the hate. And then your despair that once more you're hating. And then you're embarrassed. And then you're depressed. And then, all these attitudes kind of keep building. So the idea in mindfulness practice is a training, and it's a slow training for some people. It takes a long, long time, a lot of patience is needed, to learn this wonderful thing, phenomenal, very powerful thing, of simply being aware and leaving it at that. Oh, neurosis. Oh, that's how it is. Or neurosis, hate. Oh, look, hate. That's how it is. Hate. No. Look at that. It's not okay to be so like that. It's not okay to be open and non-reactive. It's not okay. Oh, look at that. I was open, and now my attitude is it's not okay. It's not safe, or it's selfish, or I'm not protect, you know, something. So very quickly, these attitudes come into play. And slowly, what we can learn is to start leaving things alone. Leaving things alone. But not leaving them alone without attention. We bring our attention. We keep our attention there. We stay present. We stay with it. Whether it's with a friend who's, you know, I've been with people who, you know, have been in conflict with people and they've been angry with me. And the mindfulness practice has taught me how to stay present without me getting caught up in reactions and funny attitudes. Just, okay, oh, this is what it's like to have a friend angry with me. You know, now if you're too non-reactive, in that kind of situation, they get angry again. So you have to kind of be non-reactive and responsive. Oh, yeah, I understand. But it's a very, very helpful thing to learn this quality. And once you can learn this quality of very simple, very innocent, very, very simple, just be present, be aware, be attentive, then you can also have better choices of how to respond. So we say, many people say these days, that we make a huge difference between being reactive versus being responsive. And the ability to pause and be mindful, makes space for wise response. That's not possible if we're being reactive. So in order to we pay attention to the breath, we pay attention to the body, sensations, experience of our body, physical world. We pay attention to our emotions. We pay attention to our thoughts. And all that allows you to have better access to understand the variety of different ways in which you enter into relationship with life and the way in which the attitude you have about life. And then as you understand that better and better, then you have the opportunity to live a wiser life, but hopefully a freer life. And hopefully a freer life is a life where the quality of your inner life, of your heart, your mind, is really beautiful. Something that you really love, that you really kind of value, as opposed to something that you're afraid of or bored with or, you know. And as the quality of the inner life changes and gets better, hopefully it also becomes less influenced by the way the world is. And so it's possible to go to work and have obnoxious coworkers and not be influenced by that. The heart stays open, luminous, radiant, relaxed, peaceful. Oh, look at that. That was obnoxious. Amazing. And even more amazing, it was towards me. Wow. That's amazing. 5 billion years of evolution produced this obnoxious moment. Isn't that something? So it transforms our relationship, you know, to the world. And we're less influenced by the world. But not being influenced by the world is still in relationship to us. People respond to us. And so as we are present, hopefully with a better quality of heart and mind, better attitude, better relationship to things, the world tends to respond to that. And you'll probably find the world responds to you in nicer ways. So other concerns, questions you might have?
I'm just enthralled with what you've talked about, especially the latter half of this tonight, and I wanted to grab something and start writing notes.
Oh, so it's an attitude of wanting.
I guess, so my question really is, this is, you probably don't, is this written anyplace where I can read it again? Or I think I have the essence of paying attention. It just reaches out so far. What you described tonight is like way bigger. Way bigger than I thought.
Uh-oh, sorry.
No, love it. It's wonderful. No.
Okay, great. I don't know if anything is written in the way I talked about it this tonight, myself. But this is basically a summary of maybe I should use the B word. This is a summary of Buddhism. This is what Buddhism is about.
Thank you.
My book. Well, I don't think I have a chapter on this topic in that book, do I? It's a long time since I read it. How would I know? No, I don't think so. No, I did have in mind to try to write. I don't have even a handout of this for this topic today, because this. But I thought of. But I didn't have time to write it this week. What I do have instead is we have the fifth week handout, which is a walking meditation. And a big part of our particular tradition of mindfulness meditation is also includes doing meditation while we walk. And so people often associate meditation with sitting meditation, but in Buddhism, this walking is also done. And on retreats, in particular, we do almost as much walking meditation as we do sitting meditation. And so there's a handout today about walking meditation. But I'm sorry I couldn't give you some specific to read. Write about it. Yes.
So in one of the chapters of the book, you'd mentioned this at an earlier lecture when it was the steps of recognition, naming, accepting, and then investigating.
Yeah.
So if I understand you correctly, then the investigation is just being mindful. It's not adding stories. It's not saying, well, what does that mean? Then what does that mean? Then what does that mean?
Yes.
You're just being mindful. And I think that what you're saying is with the practice, the answers just come.
See, it's a little dangerous to generalize like that. There are definitely important times in life to ask questions, you know, what's the meaning, to analyze. Those are important parts of life. And mindfulness, the instructions you get in mindfulness practice is not supposed to wipe away other wise ways of living in your life. And some people listen to the mindfulness instructions and think, that's I'm only supposed to be mindful now, non-reactively mindful. But when you do mindfulness practice, when that's what you're actually setting yourself to do, then mindfulness itself is not analysis in the sense of asking what's the meaning. Let me think back. What happened yesterday that caused me to feel this way today, and all that. It's just staying with what is. And the investigation is more like having the question, what is this? Or let's look at it more carefully here. Let's be a bit closer. Let's put a magnifying glass at it, or let's feel it more carefully. It's like if you're going to investigate the taste of an orange, so you could write about it. You would kind of feel, you'd sense and savor the aroma, the smell, the taste of the orange. You wouldn't be thinking, So there's a kind of sensory quality of that investigation, but you have to really get into it. What is this really? So investigation is an important thing. And part of investigation in Buddhist practice is also to begin making simple distinctions between what is helpful and what is not. The simple distinctions between what is causing suffering and what is not causing suffering. So it's not analysis, not figuring out, not calculating, but in the moment-to-moment experience, to notice that if I'm not sure what to say next, and I start thinking, well, what are these people going to think of me? And then, my mind is going towards suffering. There wasn't suffering, and now it's going towards suffering. It's a very simple distinction. So investigation, it allows you to see that distinction and see the difference between it, as opposed to just seeing, oh, that's suffering, now I'm suffering more and more. It's like, oh, that's suffering, right next to it there was not freedom from suffering. You see that distinction. And then I let go of my concern, my you know. And so I don't know how well I said that, but...
Let me ask you a question. Like, I listened to one of your earlier lectures on anger, and you were talking about an acronym called MADLIS.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you remember that.
Hardly. So, it's a problem with these tapes.
So I'm not going to go over the whole thing because it's going to take away from what you're talking about, but I guess my question is, like, if I'm angry and then I think, is this a cover for expectation or hurt or sadness? It's helpful to investigate something that way because then it helps me to then realize, oh, you know, so that's why I'm angry. But if I start getting caught up in, and then I start thinking and thinking and thinking, it makes me more angry. I think what I understand you saying is you can just simply ask yourself if the investigation is causing more suffering or not.
Perfect. Perfect. Bingo. So part of the investigation, you know, if you're regularly looking at what's the relationship I have to what's going on here, and you notice that your approach you're taking in the practice is making you more agitated, then something is off. So then it becomes self-correct, and you go, okay, correct for that. Okay, that approach, now that I'm trying to analyze and figure out what's going on, just making my mind spin more and more, that's not the right way to go. I have the information to know I need to back off. So hopefully this is a self-correcting process. As you're being mindful, as you include all these different fields in your mindfulness, in particular your relationship to what's going on, it becomes self-correcting. And there are sometimes that people get in trouble during mindfulness practice. Or should I say it differently? People get in trouble trying to do mindfulness practice. But if you keep noticing what's going on, and you particularly notice your relationship to what's going on, it becomes a self-correcting process, as you're indicating. So, I hope that enough of you, all of you, understood what I was trying to say today. I've never taught this week before. This is a new addition to the... It used to be a five-week course only. And I wouldn't teach all this the way I taught today. But earlier this summer, I got really inspired. I said, I need to add this piece about the quality of the mind into the... So today was my first attempt to try to get this across. So I felt a little bit that I was kind of being a little bit confusing at times, so I apologize if that was the case. Come back next time and I'll have it refined. And thank you very much.